So there are four of us this morning who are going to talk about this new topic, transcendental dependent arising. And I wanted to share why. Everybody's been asking me when we first heard what the topic was, and I said, "Oh, this is just what we need right now." So I'm going to share why that was my knee-jerk reaction, and it's still my reaction. For the past few months, I've had to be on social media more than I like because of my work and some very nice things that are going on in my professional life, but I have to market myself. So I have been on social media, and any of you who have been or just reading the news, you know how things just come at you and the angst of people has been just so clear that it's been difficult to just kind of keep myself centered. And that is what this month, I think, is all about. It's this moment of choice when we feel ourselves being pulled up in the emotion and we have a choice. We can spin off into dukkha and just let it cook and season it and let it go. Or we can say, I have faith that in my practice, in coming back to compassion, to metta, to caring, I'm going to move into joy and I'm going to bring joy to others. And I really like this poem that I've kept on my desk for years. It's a little card, and it's Dropping Keys by Hafiz. And to me, it's the essence of what this moment is with this dukkha. The small man builds cages for everyone he knows, while the sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful, rowdy prisoners. I'll read it again. The small man builds cages for everyone he knows, while the sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful, rowdy prisoners. That's the choice. Am I the small man or am I the sage? Am I going to put everything and everyone in boxes? I don't like you. I don't approve of you. I'm angry about this. Or am I going to open up and drop keys of joy, of liberation, wherever I go? Something happened yesterday morning that's a wonderful example of this. I got online, and oh my gosh, I saw videos of a murder, Alex Preti's murder, and I was so spun up. And I went upstairs to do something. And my husband came in and said, "Oh, I'll join you." And he reached for something I was about to reach for. And I went, "No, I was here first." And I grabbed it from him. And I thought, I looked at his face. He was so bewildered. And I thought, oh, I brought all of this angst up the stairs and threw it at him. This man that I love, who was just joining me in something in the kitchen. And I thought, yeah, this is exactly what I'm talking about tomorrow morning. Oh my gosh. And for the rest of the day, I was so conscious of moving into metta. You know, in Tuareg's talk a few weeks ago, she made it clear we're not escaping our dukkha, but becoming intimate with it while also making a choice. And man, did I become intimate with how I can just bring this with me in this wake. Let's be real. The mess in the world isn't going to miraculously heal. We're not going to wake up one morning and there's no dukkha. So we choose this path to liberation of our hearts from greed, hatred, and delusion. Not dukkha, from greed, hatred, and delusion. I loved what Lauren read about how choosing to go from dukkha to faith brings us into a chain of dependent arisings that leads through many kinds of happiness. And I'd also say contentment and quiet peace to liberation. And when inwardly we are following this path, we are going to radiate this out to the world. It's how we are going to affect the people with whom we interact during the day. And that's our choice in this moment. And that's why I think, wow, could there be a more perfect topic to spend this year on than transcendental dependent arising? I don't think so. I'm so excited about this. And I hope you are too. And now I'm going to pass it on to Suze.
Whew, thank you, Candace. And hi, everybody. We've only been talking about this topic for a couple weeks, but I've already been gaining some more understanding. There have been some wonderful tidbits from just the first few weeks. Nana started it out, and one of the things I took from him was, enlightenment arises out of dukkha. Then Lindell, among many other things, reminded us that there are skillful and unskillful ways of working with dukkha. And Nina reminded us that another way might be possible. And then Tiwari, as Candace was talking about, talked about a choice point. We can either go through the dukkha to more confusion and sink in the muck of it all, or we can begin a noble search. So for my few minutes, I want to talk about how I've been practicing with dukkha and how my practice has matured over the years. For way too many years, I kind of skipped over dukkha and immediately went to strategies for working with it. It took me some time in maturing to realize that what I was really practicing with was aversion to the dukkha, escaping it, like Candace was talking about, instead of becoming intimate with it. So there are six ways that I tried skipping over dukkha, and then five ways that I actually matured and developed a different relationship. The first way I skipped over it was I compared my pain with others, and mine never measured up to other people's. I was raised in a family with a disabled sister and a very sad mother, and it just never seemed like mine was equal to it. A second way is I thought that an intellectual understanding of dukkha was enough, and I forgot about actually experiencing it fully in my body. I totally had forgotten about Vedana, which is the second foundation of mindfulness, and it took me some time to realize what an essential part of the practice that is what is coming up, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then that kind of forms the foundation for what I do with it. I did a bunch of spiritual bypass, and I would jump to metta. I don't feel good. This is awful. I think I'll just do metta for myself. Well, we could have a whole year just talking about how all the different ways we've done spiritual bypass. Another way is that I saw everything as something to be fixed. In my family, the best compliment you could get is, she's got this, she can handle it. And so, yay, that I do have certain competences and I can handle a lot of things, and it's helpful. But the problem is, there's two problems with that. One is that I took on that identity that, oh, I've got this, I can handle it. And now that I'm a pretty old lady, I can't always handle it. And the other one, which is even more important, is that some of the dukkha that arises in our lives needs to just be lived and lived through, not fixed. And the last way I skipped over it is I am by nature an optimist. Joy is easily accessible to me, and yay that's my nature, but it can get out of balance and it can lead to not seeing clearly. I've shared that the negative side of the joyful is Susie Sunshine, and she doesn't see very clearly through the shadows and the dark. So how did I then learn how to practice with dukkha more skillfully? One of the first ways is that I got to know people who did that and who didn't skip over it, who were really brave. One of them is my partner of, it would have been 43 years today. He was so brave. In his 20s, he had a nervous breakdown and was suicidal. And I met him when he was in his late 30s, and I found a person who didn't shy away from the pain, who came to understand that the only way through it was through it. I reread Philip's book, Dancing with Life, so many times, and I finally understood the three insights that he talks about, that you reflect on the dukkha, which I've been pretty good at. But then you have that felt sense of the experience. You feel the awe of it or the ouch of it. And then you really know what you know and you embody it. Another way is that my practice over the years has been very directed towards practicing the Dharma in daily life. I don't wait till when I'm back on the cushion to kind of bring the Dharma with me. In my daily life, in my business, dealing with tenants and vendors and stuff, I watch the mind have an unwholesome thought or view arise, and I see what's happening there, and I wait. I've learned to be pretty good at pausing, and I wait and see what else is there. When there's greediness arising, is there also some generosity? If there's deceit, is there some truth? And then another way is I've really worked on this balancing with Susie Sunshine. And one of the things that helps that most is dedicating my practice to being with and seeing things that are actually happening. Finding that balance of what I want, what is actually happening, and what's my moral code. And at last, I know that I don't practice for myself alone. Candace already talked about this, that what I do matters. Even in my small little world where the people I interact with, if I'm walking around in delusion and ill will and greediness and or sunk into unskillful views and opinions, those around me are affected by it. And if I can be diligent and practice seeing what is actually happening and being aligned with my sense of morality, I can make wise choices and my actions can benefit those around me. Or at the very least, I do as little harm as possible. When Tewari gave the instruction that we go from dukkha to uplift, which is the next step before faith, in order to find the uplift, we can't skip over the dukkha. Thanks for listening. And I will now turn it over to Lauren. Lauren, you're muted.
Yeah, okay. So thank you, Suze. My experience is different from Suze's in specifics, but there is a lot of similarity. I remember studying the dependent origination in 2020 with Sims, which was the first time I saw these links that were connected and explained to me. This is helping me understand how the concept of a self is developed, and therefore it helps me understand what I might do to not have, you know, be stuck with that concept of self. And so the concept of self, I could see from studying the dependent origination links that, you know, I couldn't control it specifically. It just happened. One thing would lead to another, but I could have a choice with the conditions that supported it. And I also saw how that concept of self led to suffering. So when the transcendental arising was presented with these links, I thought, oh, this is really going to help with leaving suffering. And I was very happy to that we were going to do it this year. So I saw that the 12 links of transcendental dependent arising and the 12 links of dependent origination all had suffering, but suffering began and ended dependent origination, but the suffering in transcendental ended in awakening. So I thought, this is really interesting. And something new appears right after suffering in transcendental dependent origination, and that's faith. And so I said, suffering is linked to faith? That's very interesting. And I started to think about my own experience with suffering and faith. And does faith follow? Do I have an experience with that? It's the transcendental, those links are a natural unfolding. So that step from suffering to faith is a natural. There's a rising of this, which would be suffering. There will be a rising of that. So there is a natural way there can be the arising of faith right after suffering. And without the arising of this, there won't be the arising of that. Or the Buddha said outright, suffering is the supporting condition for faith. So I thought, okay, let me think of my own experience. And I started thinking about how has my relationship to dukkha been transformed by faith? Where does faith come in? In contrast to faith, what are my fixed reactions to suffering? Do I fear? Do I avoid? Do I deny? Do I get angry? And I went back to fear. Yeah, waking up in the night, feeling something is wrong, and not just wrong, terribly wrong, feeling I've got to do something about this. I remember Tuari talking about the quick fix in her talk earlier in the month. She called it the boomerang fix, a temporary one that keeps the problem coming back. I didn't know why I was waking up with this feeling of something wrong. And I just thought, I don't need to know why. I wanted to go away. It happened often and I couldn't tie it to anything. I tried to distract myself and go back to sleep as quickly as possible, whatever would work. And then I saw that the feeling went away in the daylight on its own, and I comforted myself with the knowledge that I could avoid the feeling just by waking up. I could have spent most of my time in denial like this and forgotten about it until it came up again. If it weren't for the second arrow, I probably would have let it go. But I started noticing some extra unwholesome showing things showing up. In addition to, I have to fix this, I saw myself judging and comparing. I was not just saying something is terribly wrong. I was saying something is wrong with me. Other people don't wake up in the night with bad feelings like this, especially if they're following the Dharma path. This shouldn't be happening. So my response was in ignorance to the truth, which is the start of dependent origination. I wasn't recognizing the three characteristics of anicca, not permanent, anatta, not personal, and dukkha, not perfect. So the bottom one was, it was a feeling, an unpleasant feeling, and I just wanted to get away from it. But the Dharma was kind of starting to do me, as Sue says. So over time, I started doing something different with it. I decided to stay with it. I told myself that I would hold the feeling and learn about it. And to me, that is a step of faith, because I didn't know if it was going to be fixed. You know, my original goal was fix it, but I didn't know if I could fix it. I didn't know what was next. So even though I had labeled it something terribly wrong, I suspended my belief that it wasn't okay. This was a bad thing and it was not okay. And I started to soften and widen around it, which was something I learned from Ajahn Suchito. So this is waking up in the night, feeling that feeling and saying, okay, what is this? Trying to explore it and staying in the body. There's my time. Okay, let me turn that off. So anyway, I just will quickly say what I did. So let's see, where was I? Yeah, so I stayed in the body and I noticed that the feeling changed. And because I was in the moment, just feeling it, that the label started, the terribly wrong started to fade away. So now it was, you know, maybe kind of unpleasant, you know, like it was, but the label wasn't so important. And then the feeling was unpleasant, but then it disappeared too. In fact, often the feeling would become a kind of calm happiness. It just was the present. It was just a feeling. And so to me, that was faith, because I didn't know that that was going to happen. And in fact, this continues. I still wake up in the night with that feeling, and I stay with it, and it keeps happening. It moves. So I'm learning to have a relationship with this dukkha and finding that the dukkha is moving and it's not permanent and it flows, it arises, it fades away if I let go of it and have faith that there is something else, there is another way. And now I'll pass it on to Judith.
Thank you, Lauren. I would say at this point, what I have is a lot of questions and germs of ideas. I started meditating with Seattle Insight in the middle of 2020. So I don't remember anything about studying dependent arising at all. So I had a little catch up to do there. And I read a wonderful article by Christina Feldman yesterday, which went through all the stages of dependent arising. And my impression had been that this was like the wheel of samsara, basically. You just dukkha to dukkha and you don't get off. And basically she confirmed that. So it is wonderful for me also to be studying the transcendental dependent arising, the way off the circle. So my first thought when I read these 12 steps was, this must take a really long time to get through all of these 12 steps. You know, maybe lifetimes, if you believe in reincarnation. But then Tuari, Monday before last, said, no, this can happen in a flash. just like this, the whole thing, although you may not end up totally at the end. You might end up, say, in dispassion. That's the example she gave. But it can happen in a flash. And then Arv, last Monday night, said that we often get to a certain point, and then we fall back, and then we start over, and, you know, so it seems like there is a lot of variety in how long it takes to get from one step to another, and how many times we start over, and I think we're all familiar with that process. But it does seem to me that each time we start these steps, that faith is the linchpin, basically. It's, do we step into faith or do we stay on the wheel? And once we step into faith, then we're on our way. And so I'm asking, okay, well, how and why do we make that shift, that leap of faith, I guess you could call it? Tuareg talked about, as Suze mentioned, having uplifted attention in the face of dukkha that leads us into that step. But then I'm saying, how do we get there, right? I know there's this old, I guess it's a saying, I think it's from the Buddhist tradition, that if you're ready to wake up, a single leaf falling from a branch can do it. If you're not ready, the whole tree can fall on you and nothing happens. So is it just a case of ready or not? I don't know. And I know the Buddha says that all people have the potential to wake up. And so now this indicates to me that this is something we know at a very deep level. You know, if we get past the veil of our conditioning, we know there is a way. We know there is a way. And that everybody knows it at this deep level. But we've forgotten. We've forgotten because of our conditioning. And so we have teachers to point it out, and hopefully that triggers the memory of what we already know. And then we get this uplifted attention, and then we step into faith. If we're ready, right? So I've also noticed that people's reaction to the word faith can be very negative, because so many of us have grown up in Orthodox religion, which is basically telling us to believe whatever the doctrine says, to have faith in things we have no evidence for, right? And this is, in other words, blind faith, I guess I would call that. But this is not that kind of faith. This is faith with evidence, right? We have, if we don't remember what we already know, we at least have the example of other people who have followed this path, and it has worked. Or maybe we've started, and we are beginning to see improvements in our own life. And then that is something, when we fall back, you know, we can remember that. So I think faith as remembrance is actually very practical. It's very practical. And, you know, basically it's presented to us not as, okay, take my word for this and you just have to believe this forever, but it's like, try it. See if it works, right? So then if it does, basically it is a case of remembering what we already know. And so I'm going to be thinking a lot about faith, because I'm going to be talking about faith on February 8th. And so that's kind of the start of what I'm exploring, right? Okay, so we are going to stay in the big group today, as Lauren said. And I just want to say, before we start, I know that some people feel shy about speaking up in Well, both in the big group and in breakout groups. And I get that because I have felt that way. I have. And I just want to say, I mean, I don't want to put pressure on anyone. If you just need to listen, listen, that's fine. But this is a safe place and a supportive place. We respect each other. We don't interrupt each other. We don't give advice unless it's asked for, you know. Yeah, and so if there is something that you really want to ask or share, I guess I would encourage you to take the plunge. I did, and it worked out fine. So, okay. And also feel free to ask questions of any of the four of us who talked today. So, let me change my view here so I can see everybody. A good way is to raise your virtual hand down in the React section. Okay, so anybody have anything to say? How are you? Are you beginning to practice with this, if you are? Liz.
Morning. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Sweet. All right. I really appreciated all of your insights. I just was so, it was great tasty bites there. All of it. Your poem. I had to go quickly go grab my phone to find out the poem that Candace, you read. That was really just really beautiful. And the idea of you can't skip over the dukkha was really the spiritual bypassing, because I feel like sometimes that is what I want to try and do. I have a lot of fear around anxiety and depression and the waking up in the middle of the night, like Lauren said. Growing up when I was younger, I did struggle with depression. And so the spiritual bypass sure seems really great. You know, I can hop on into meta. I can be like, try and sail through hard things in this way that I'm like, oh, I'm making it happen. And then I'm realizing like, that feeling tone, you can't escape dukkha. And having faith in that path, like having that faith to like find the path of just going through it and not necessarily guaranteeing the idea that it necessarily means, I mean, there might be depression and there might be anxiety and there might be hardship, but that's part of it. And having faith that there is the Buddha, the Sangha, the Dhamma, the path, the whole of it to get through it. So I really appreciate all of you guys. And it's funny. I kind of do this little thing while I was sitting there talking. I'm like, there's a little path, dukkha, faith. We have a spiritual bypass, some more dukkha, and then appears a little writing that says, still more dukkha. So it's still keeps on going. But I'm grateful for all your words. Thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you, Liz. I know it took me quite a while to realize that the way to deal with dukkha was to actually sit with it, right? Not to escape it. And it's amazing what happens, you know, because it does start to ease, but it's doing it naturally. And then to have faith that that works, yeah. To remember that that works, yeah. Okay, faith, speaking of faith. What a beautiful name you have, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just saying, that was one of the things that I keep noticing is my name keeps on being brought up today. And it's interesting to live with that name. And I'm full of doubt, have been all my life, and skepticism. I wanted to, and so I have questions about some of the things that you're talking about, because although I've meditated for a long time, I know very little about Buddhism itself. And so I don't know, I didn't study any of this, so, and I'm catching up. Anything that you can put in the chat that you can think, oh, read this, that'll help. With that, that's one of my favorite ways to cope, is intellectually. So I'm there if you want to help me that way. But I wanted to specifically speak to Suze, because almost everything you said just banged at me. Optimism, bypassing, and reactivity, you know, explosive reactivity. That, you know, I have a choice to just be totally awash in my emotion, or just to say, I'm fine. And I can help someone else. And let me help. Let me fix all of that. And how to, as Judith and Lauren were both saying, how to sit and just be with it is what I think I'm learning from you all right now. And so I just want to thank you. And I guess beginner's mind is a good thing. I sure have that. And I have a lot of faith. So I finally feel like my name fits instead of being a total anomaly. So there's that too. But anyway, thank you all.
I just want to say we do have on the website, there is a tab for resources, yeah, which lists all sorts of things, talks and books and yeah.
I just found that. I'm not very good at websites and stuff, but I did.
And the more you do it, the better you'll get.
Yeah. And if I may just respond quickly to something that Faith said. Yeah. I think there's another option. You talked about being awash in stuff, being reactive, or wanting to help somebody else. I think the best gift and the best option is to pause and do nothing and see what arises when you're awash in it. Like Tim said to me one day when I was talking about being awash in the storm, he said, can you just be okay with the storm? Which then says, oh, maybe I just like pause and I'm not going to do anything about the storm. Just kind of stay with it. And that doesn't mean you have to be on the cushion. You can be walking around. You can be fixing dinner. You can be talking to whoever. Pausing and seeing what shows up. Seeing what else shows up. And there's something about the faith in other things showing up, because by nature, we're way more complicated. We're not just...
Oh, wait.
All of a sudden, I got muted. Anyway, that was the pausing, I think, is the real step.
Yes.
I heard that from Judith and Lauren also, and that just take a minute here.
Yep.
That's the part. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Faith. Okay, Julie.
Hi. Thank you to everyone on the panel. That was all very, very useful. I want all the reminders, Suze's recent reminder to just take a pause. I really like the, can you be okay with the storm? And not having to fix everything. As a parent, my son has been struggling. He's been sick and he's just got some anxiety, and it's so painful, so hard to watch your kid go through that, and I'm so uncomfortable with it. And I want to fix. I have this overwhelming urge to just fix it for him or for me. Just the suffering is so hard. But yeah, I've had to try to learn to just be with it. And everything is okay in this moment, truly. But I really like, can you be okay with the storm? Because yeah, there's all this stuff going on, and it's a storm. It will pass. And it's just uncomfortable. And ironically, I get really frustrated and uncomfortable because he's so anxious and uncomfortable. And I'm like, why can't you just sit with it? Why can't you just be? You're sick. It's okay. But I see that I'm doing the exact same thing he's doing. So I'm going to try to sit with this storm.
Great.
That's all. Thank you.
Yeah. And if any of the other three of you have something to say in response to any of these comments, please jump in.
Well, I was just going to.
Okay. You were next anyway, so you might.
Yeah. What Julie was just talking about, and earlier Liz, was the depression, that fear that those of us who have experienced depression have with sitting with our dukkha. It can be very frightening, very threatening. And something that a teacher once suggested to me was, hold your depression, hold this fear in love, and just, oh, I know. It can be really scary to be me right now because of these memories. And I can sit with this, I can hold this. And instead of ignoring it and then it's just gonna come back, I can just say, I love you too. And you've got reasons for this. And then it isn't spiritual bypassing. It's the metta is actually holding this pain and this fear, and it softens it and it allows us to be with it. So I just wanted to share that because I think a lot of us have that fear, and it's part of us, and it needs our love rather than our, no, not you. It needs our love. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd also like to say that if you're dealing with really heavy trauma, you might need, you know, you might want to get, in addition to meditation, you might also need therapy. I mean, that does not mean that you've failed. And there are a lot of therapists who actually use mindfulness meditation as well. But just, you know, if you're struggling with something that is so overwhelming that you can't sit with it without it overwhelming you, don't hesitate to get help. Yeah. Okay, Carolyn.
I just wanted to say that I think Sue's comments about not skipping over the dukkha is so important. And I have been listening to a book by Tenzin Palmo, The Heroic Heart. And one of the things she said is that it's really important that rather than escaping from difficult situations in our life, we try to just bring them on the path with us. And I think that that's a really good point, because sometimes I find I get overwhelmed by the pain of the difficult situations that I encounter in my day-to-day life or in our world. And I think it's in our nature to want to push them away, you know, or to not feel them. But I'm fairly new to practice. I've been practicing for about a year and a half. And what I've found is that when I greet the dukkha with questions about why it's here and try to understand it, And then, as Candace was saying, embrace it and say, you know, and comfort myself and recognize that this, that having these feelings are a part of being human, you know, and they're natural. And it's through feeling them and understanding them that we get wisdom. And somehow I think our ego kind of goes down too, like a little bit of ego death happens. And when that happens, it, your system calms down and you develop some wisdom and insight. And I think that's when you're able to respond rather than react. And one of the things that I think is the hardest things to do, I've reflected a lot on this quote from Viktor Frankl, which is, between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. And I love that quote because I feel like that's really true. If we can pause and breathe and come back to our true self, we'll figure out how to respond with wisdom rather than react. And usually the outcomes of situations are transformed, I think, when that happens. Versus if we get so wrapped up in the feelings, sometimes we can react and the outcome won't, maybe not be a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is really coming back to our true self. That's really a case of remembering, right? And it was listening to all of you talk, it strikes me how much our culture wants us to escape, right? It puts so many distractions out there. Oh, well, we can watch something on Netflix, or we can eat something sweet, or we can have a glass of wine, or we can do this, or we can go party, or, you know, on and on and on. The level of distractions, the number of distractions that are available to us now is just incredible. And so when we start on a spiritual path, and then we, you know, eventually start to kind of see through some of that, then I think it's easy to transfer that to what Suze is talking about, the spiritual bypass. You know, like, okay, I know that watching another movie is really not going to do this for me, but I could do metta and then I can feel better, right? Anyway, just something that just occurred to me. Yeah. Anybody else? We have 4 minutes. Yes, Suze.
Just reflecting on so much of what people have said, there's both the beauty of the don't know mind, where it was kind of like Lauren was talking about removing the labels, and the labels are so much about, well, I know what this is, you know, and there it is. And that kind of don't know mind, where you offer the mind some freedom from all of that. And then the knowing, which is, you know, which comes from the practice, where there are certain things you do know. You know, we know when we're behaving skillfully and wholesomely, and so that I don't know if it's a paradox or what, but it's both don't know and do know. And how we walk through that is, I think, part of this path as well. Acknowledging what we do know, and then questioning some of the things that we think we know, but it's really just feeding some of the crap. I don't know if that's true for other people. It sure is true for me. Anyway, it really came through with so much of what people are saying.
Yeah, and I think that our ability to know if we're acting skillfully increases as we're on the path, because there's a real tendency to rationalize our own feelings and our own actions, you know. Oh, well, I should be angry at this, right? I should be mad or I should be lashing out because this is obviously terrible. And I find myself feeling that way sometimes when these horrible things happen in the world. I say, well, we should be angry. And I said, but what is my anger accomplishing? Nothing. Nothing. I'm just throwing more anger out there into an already charged situation. So I think our ability to see that increases as we practice. Yeah. Okay, anybody else before? Yes, Candace.
I just wanted to say that every time we do that, you know, choose the anger, we really are putting people in cages.
Yep.
We're deciding that I'm here and you're there and we can't communicate. And I want to get rid of that. Mm-hmm. You know, with the practice, I want to stop that.
Yeah.
And it's hard.
Yeah, likewise. Okay, well, if we don't have any more comments, then I will turn this over to Suze.
Yeah, so thanks everybody, and you know, Sangha is just something to celebrate. There's so much wisdom and honesty and trust, and I appreciate you all very much. So the intro classes started last week, and it's my understanding that you can still join the second week, which means that this coming Wednesday and Thursday, Wednesday on the east side with Steve Wilhelm, Thursday on the west side with Carrie. I've taken the beginning class, I don't know, 5 or 6 times. I've taken friends with me, and it's really quite lovely. The 6-week class will end on February 28th, which is a day long. Put it in your calendars. It's really nice to go to a day long. And also, the new students appreciate the calm and non-wiggling that some of us who've been around longer can do. Next Saturday, the 31st of January, and Sunday the 1st of February, there's a non-residential retreat with our founding teacher, Rodney Smith. There will not be a Sunday sit next Sunday, because whenever we do a non-residential, we support that event and encourage people to go. For those of you who are newer to Seattle Insight, take this opportunity. It really never matters to me what Rodney's teaching about. This time he's blending the Heart Sutra with the Four Foundations. His personal practice is so deep, and his teaching style is pretty dynamic and wise. And if you're able to go, just you register and you'll get the link. It's just online. It's also a wonderful thing to set up your house for a meditation retreat. That in and of itself is a good practice and hard, because there's so much in the house that is saying, pay attention to me. And then the usual things of the drop-in sits, the under 40. We have a brand new thing that if you're in Seattle and if you're able, on Wednesdays, Carrie Peterson, one of our guiding teachers, will be in person at Seattle Insight from 12 to 1. They're calling it a still point sit. So I think it'll be a sit and some Dharma conversation. I haven't been able to get there yet, but I'm going to try to make it. So if that's something that you can do. I just wanted to end with this particular dedication of merit that comes from Jack Kornfield. There's some really beautiful words. So kind of reestablish yourself in this relaxed and receptive place. And here are his words. As we move through this beautiful and troubled world, may we vow to be a beacon of peace, a fearless carrier of respect and loving kindness for all life, a teller of truth, a voice for justice, a protector of those who are vulnerable or targeted. May the power of wisdom, integrity, and compassion be our guide. May all beings here in our Sangha, in our small communities, and worldwide know the end of suffering. May all beings be safe and find ease and peace in the storms of their lives. As Lauren said at the opening, if you would like to stay online for a while, just to chat with each other, maybe to share some more comments, we're going to keep the Zoom link open for however long, no longer than a half hour, but if you can wait for your lunch or your next cup of coffee or whatever, please stay and join us. And thank you all so very much.
Suze, would it be possible to get a copy of this, those words by Jack Kornfield?
I can send them to you for sure.
That would be great.
Yeah. It's, I don't know where I found it originally, but I have a file on my computer of dedications of merit. And so this was one of them. Yeah, I'd be happy to, Carol.
Yeah, thanks. I have to leave now to have breakfast with Jim.
Okay. Say hi to Jim.
Yeah.
Nice to see you.
Bye, Carol.
Bye. Thank you all.
This is a pretty open-ended. You don't have to raise your hand or anything. You can just unmute, and we'll be careful about not talking over each other. But anything you'd like to share or ask or just... it's so nice to get to know people, even that we're only seeing each other in these little boxes.
Hi, everyone. My name is Surabhi. This was my first sit with Sims. I've been practicing on and off. My first Vipassana course was in 2013, and I've done one after. So I've mainly practiced on my own through these years, other than a few sits here and there. But I think, and I loved the how we started out with, you know, just given current circumstances and where we find ourselves in. One of the things that I've noticed for myself is, through my practice, I think I'm very good with sitting with things and not using other distractions to take away from that unpleasant feeling. But I think I fall at the other end where, because I sit with it so much, I then don't kind of act in terms of loving kindness to other people, or just I get so in my head that it's no longer... I don't think I'm, it's not acceptance, more like just such a dispassionate observer that it's no longer kind to me or anybody else around. And I'm hoping that the sittings and just like the sense of community, I think might help with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for your such an honest sharing. I think those of us who've been sitting with Seattle Insight for some time really appreciate the sense of Sangha. And one of the things of just knowing that some of the craziness in our own minds is shared with other people, that some of it's just the nature of being alive in these human bodies and minds, and that not taking everything quite so personally really helps from sitting in Sangha. It's like what Lauren said earlier about the three characteristics, that things aren't perfect, aren't personal or permanent. And yeah, so thanks for being here. And look on our website, there's a lot of opportunities to be with others. And yeah, we would welcome you to join any of those.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Well, I'm in the same boat as you, Surapi, you know, and I think I have also, you know, it's really isolated manners and practice. And then I've been meditating, practicing long times about since 2012, not consistent with on and off, but longer I meditate and longer I, you know, sit with myself, my senses, my capacity to recognize my energy, and with that same as well, and also I can pick up others' energy too well, you know. So it's difficult, even I feel, to find the right group for me, because when there's such a disingenuine the energetic, you know, right, and those atmosphere and surroundings, and you try to work with your own dukkha, say, and own difficulty, and learning to sit with it and accept it and add to that, and then from others and just coming at you, it gets too much sometimes. Mm. So that's why I've been avoiding people. Then without going out there and know people communicating also on the other hand, similar like you, it's what's the point? I'm doing this and I don't know. It's always with myself alone, but I really don't know how I'm going to be with others, and, you know, how am I going to react, whether really I'm, you know, really gaining this insight and really it's benefiting me or not. So, and that's why I decided to join this group and give it a try recently as well. And we'll see. Hopefully this time is good. You know, I have tried groups before, but I always left. But hopefully this one worked out.
I think for me, Deggy, I get a lot of inspiration to take my practice just along with me wherever I go. And I used to have interviews with Rodney a couple times a year for many years, and he would always ask, how's your sitting practice? And I'd go, oh, it's so-so. How's your life practice? It was really good. And he was so supportive of me bringing the Dharma into my daily life. And of course, I need the sitting practice because I can just spin out and whatever. I started it really small, in really small ways. So I used to run a recycling company, and I'd have these drivers come, and I would just, in the morning, practice with, can I just be kind and friendly to each of these people, even the ones who were causing a lot of difficulty? Little small things that I would bring from my practice, because the practice supports being kind and respectful and generous and all of that. I would just pick one little thing and do that. And then sometimes on my way home, I had to drive at 5 a.m. to go where the drivers were. On my way home, I would reflect on how did I do? What else came up? So there was this driver who was always a problem. And what happened when I just tried to be really kind and supportive of him? All the stuff. It was really helpful for my practice. It made me not so isolated just by myself. It was like, oh, what happens when I bring it out? In just this little example, or going to the grocery store, and How did I relate to the clerk who was checking me out? I don't know how other people, how do you all not feel so isolated or, that's only one word that both Surabhi and Deki pointed to. How do others respond to that?
I have to say, when I started with Seattle Insight, I mean, I'm actually a bit of a loner anyway, and I wasn't really feeling isolated, even though it was in the height of the pandemic when I moved back to Bellingham. But, you know, my family was here, and I had friends, and I wasn't feeling isolated, and I wasn't actually looking for community. And I just got seduced, I guess, I don't know. It just drew me in. I mean, this is just such a wonderful group. And all of a sudden, you know, Tim is asking me to train to be a local Dharma leader. And I'm thinking, what? He must be mistaken. I don't know. It just happened. It just happened. But it's so beautiful. And then I begin to realize the power of Sangha. And I have also been part of other spiritual groups, and that power was there too. But that wasn't what I was thinking about at all when I came here. I just wanted an online meditation during the pandemic. And everything else has just evolved.
Yeah. I'm a speak up for extroverts. so I have sometimes recently I thought I have too many friends because I don't know how to say no, and I didn't know. I'm a mixture. I've always loved being alone, but I did different things with it. I read a lot, I studied a lot, and I did meditation, but as you were talking about Diggy and Sigurba, I was isolating that from the rest of my life. I would meditate and think about, well, I didn't think about dukkha, but I thought about other things. And practiced. And then I would go out and just be as judgmental and as ever. So I think what you said, Suze, is very valuable, and all of you are saying valuable things, which is carrying it outside of myself and carrying it out into the world. And I have done a few things that and I'm so glad that you mentioned this particular practice, which is, you know, it's so easy to judge other people and feel and help them, which is a form of can be, if it's not carefully, skillfully done, an act of superiority or an act of helping me feel better that I've done something helpful. And so how do I just look at that person? How do I meet this person that I don't like? I'm going to help them, but I don't like them. And just look at them and not just react to what they do, but and not pity them, but just to look at them, if that makes any sense.
May I say something?
Absolutely. You don't even need to raise your hand in here, but thank you, Deki.
I already take my turn, that's why. Anyway, I thank you for the inputs, but I'm not meaning isolated in terms of, and I'm completely separate from society, and I do go out, interact with people, day-to-day life. You know, maybe I put it in the wrong way, but it is difficult to explain. But I'm just saying is that just the person I am, my personality, I'm kind of like someone who needs lots of alone time just to go inside myself. But what am I saying is I'm someone, I guess, more of to seek for genuine relationship connection, I guess. That was not, it's not something easily can come by. But, you know, workplace, moral injuries, and personal life, like everybody else, and harassment just because of my skin color and like train stations and places like that. And being a bigger person all the time is not always achievable, you know? So when I'm saying isolated, which means that, say not to belonging.
Yeah.
That probably better, but. Being extremely sensitive, and I've been meditating many years, that's why I work with my energy. When you work with my energy, you feel every cells of your body, what it's doing, every feelings, how it's connected to your body, your nervous system, is a lot to leave it in the first place anyway. But in reality, I can't live in a mountain like monks. Work with that. And I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. And since I can't isolate from myself, from society, I'm in need of part something. So.
I think for me, having Sangha described as a refuge, one of the three refuges, really gave me a different orientation, I think, toward Sangha, that it isn't just, a bunch of people who like each other and have fun together, but it actually is one of the refuges. That made a difference to me. Yeah.
Can I ask, Deggie, do you live in Seattle nearby, or are you from far away?
Oh, I live in Seattle. I've been in Seattle since 2020. I moved in here 2020, but I took a time off, went on a couple of sabbatical pilgrimage myself.
Yeah, I'm asking because when I came to Seattle Insight, I wasn't really necessarily looking for connection with people. I was just really interested in the Dharma, and I just kept going. I just thought, wow, this and this and this, and I just kept going to all these events, and then I would just volunteer a little bit, sit at the greeting table, and I met people that were so kind and sensitive and interested in the truth, you know, what was true and in the Dharma, that it just built the Sangha, you know, it just came from my interest. I would just look on the, you know, see what was going on and find myself there, and then finding people that were respectful and sensitive and were also really interested in the Dharma. And that's, yeah. That was something I could trust. So, yeah. It just kept, I kept calling it the gift that kept on giving, because I just would do one thing and then there would be more. So that's the way I feel about it. And I think it's just put yourself, you know, when I just say, I'll just show up. Showing up, just like you're doing, just showing up. You don't know what's going to happen.
Well, thank you, Lauren. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it really does help to have a association with the group and with the teacher. It's helped me a lot to keep practicing, you know, because if I was just doing it on my own, I might get confused, discouraged, you know, but it helps to know that you're not the only one out there doing this. And also to have somebody to get guidance from when you need guidance. And because it's hard. And, you know, another thing that has come to mind as you guys have been talking is I've found in my practice that it's easy to put a really high bar on how much metta we should feel and what our behavior ought to be like. We should be able to feel metta for everybody, no matter who they are, and ought to be perfect. And yet it's not that way. I mean, it's a practice for everybody. So, I mean, you may be, I know I found that I always did that, and I didn't want to do metta because it made me aware of how I wasn't good enough in terms of being loving to other people. And yet at one point, I actually started to look at, well, what's really going on? And, you know, I thought about, okay, you know, my benefactors and teachers, I really do feel kindness for them. My family and close friends, I really do feel kindness for them. People I don't know, a lot of the time I may not feel exactly kindness, but I don't have a aversive feeling, you know. So I was sort of like, you know, actually there's more there's more metta there than I was giving myself credit for. So that helped me to not be to do the practice and be willing to see the progress without having to be perfect. And that helped me a lot.
Yes, I agree. At some point you're just practicing yourself alone, no matter how much you read and, you know, and have a intellectual understanding and gaining and those things like that. At the practical level, especially when your meditation gets deeper and deeper, and definitely one requires some guidance. There's lots of things come up with. Not really, I cannot find any material from research or books. I need someone actually who's been practicing and reached a certain level can help me out, which is really difficult thing to do, you know, find and achieve. And when especially, and I mean, I've been trying other Sangha group in Boise when I used to live, and there was a small group and I used to attend that, but unfortunately I have to move and left. And yeah, I have joined group in here, there, and communicate people through online and things like that. I have done it, but I just, Vin, it's just you know, you have to feel it, and something you don't feel it, and you know that it's really disingenuous, then you just know it's not right for you, you know, and that's just how I move, and I don't make, especially my spiritual practice, I don't want anything go because there should be in certain way and in any intellectual understanding in a form, it has to come from me in. I have to be. The point of meditating is that shadow and light in everything what we have and honor that anyway. So, and I approach from that side. So that's why. So I guess it's not necessarily I am complaining or anything. It's just something what I'm harboring inside of me. And I guess I shared with you guys. There's not necessarily find a fix or anything, but you know, it's sometimes have a community people can understand, and we all teach one another, then also learning from and everyone, you know, and anyway. So that's the point of Sangha, right?
Yeah, right.
Jackie, yeah. I really identify with what some of what you were saying about, you know, having been in different groups, and some of them are, they kind of work and some don't work and stuff. And one of the things I have thought about over time is, what are the expectations that I have for Sangha? And are they realistic? Maybe a too high a bar, like Lyndall was saying about metta, that we all are these human beings with all of our failings and our beauty and our confusions, and we all come together, and then there's that soup that, you know, we're making together. And one of the things that has really helped me a lot is when I have just sometimes just mini Dharma conversations with somebody at Sangha, just, you know, you say, well, how are you? What's going on in your practice? And somebody will answer. And then you have maybe only a 5-minute conversation, but you realize, oh, right, they're working on this thing, which is really similar to something that I've been chewing on. And you learned a little bit. And then, you know, just those kinds of Dharma conversations, Dharma connections. And sometimes I've had those and then I never talk, you know, I may not see the person again. But there's, that doesn't happen out in the world as often. Sometimes it does. Sometimes I'm amazed that a stranger, shared this in Sangha some months ago. I was just walking home. I lived near one of the bridges and I was walking home and there was a person visiting from some other state and we started chatting and 5 minutes into our walk, she stopped and looked at me and she said, where does your sense of happiness come from? And so, which was so great that a stranger would ask me that. And she and I had just an amazing conversation, stranger to stranger. We never shared names. We didn't say, let's get together and become pen pals. We're just this human to human about something important. And that, I get that from Sangha a lot. And anyway, just sharing that.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Well, how's everybody doing? Do you want to stay any longer, or is lunchtime calling? Or for me, it would be breakfast. I'm a late eater.
Maybe before we go, I just want to thank you guys for the panel today. That was really nice, and I really liked the way that you talked about the transcendental dependent arising, sort of on the micro scale and on the macro scale. And both is really important, this idea that in any moment we have this choice about how we're going to work with what is painful. But then I also really love how inspirational it is to look at those steps and have this sense of that there is this logical and lawful path to the big awakening, you know. It sort of makes me feel inspired.
Yeah, I think it is very inspiring. Yeah, I think we're going to learn a lot this year.
I wrote down what Lauren shared from Joseph, that when faith is born out of suffering, instead of bewilderment and despair, it sets in motion a chain of transcendental dependent arising and goes through layers of happiness. I think I got that right. Mm-hmm. To liberation. Something like that.
Yeah. Layers of happiness.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow.
That's something to look forward to.
Yeah. Really.
And it seems like it always starts with suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people came into a spiritual path because everything was going great in their life. They were perfectly happy.
Why would you? I mean,
why would you? Exactly.
There's no need.
Exactly. I was totally miserable and homesick when I first started meditating.
Well, but also, like, I met for coffee the other day with somebody in the Sangha who I had not really gotten to know. And I said, well, how did you start practicing? And he said, when my mother died and they were really close, he stopped and he just was asking himself, well, what am I doing with my life? Mm-hmm. His life was good. He loved his wife and they have a child and his work was okay. But he was just really asking himself those kind of big questions. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's not suffering. It's big questions that a lot of us are inclined that way. Not everybody, but a lot of people who come to the practice, I think, are inclined that way as well. I wasn't arguing with you about it, but just kind of broadening. I hope it came across okay and not a dispute.
No.
Just, yeah.
And I, And there probably is some suffering in any of those big decisions, you know, those times of big decisions.
Yeah.
There's some if life is okay on the surface. Yeah.
Yeah. Or that sense of dukkha, it's not actually maybe what we would call suffering, but just a sense of there has to be more to this.
There has to be more.
Yeah. Thank you, Lyndall. That's really helpful. Yeah.
I just want to say that I started getting serious about this after having of what I felt was a feeling of awakening, of a connection with everything and the love pervading the world. And that's what brought me to this, not a suffering.
And isn't that beautiful?
And you guys are backing me up so with this idea. So thank you.
Okay, well,
thanks everybody. Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.